guest this week is a writer, editor, teacher, and author of numerous books of travel and history. She's also a friend. She and her partner founded the Living Traditions Writers Group in 1993, and for over 20 years, Larry Loyi and Constance Brissenden collaborated on a series of wonderful books, including As Long as the Rivers Flow, Goodbye Buffalo Bay, The Gathering Tree, When the Spirits Dance, The Moon Speaks Cree, and Residential Schools with the Words and Images of Survivors, and we have a number of those books here before us on the table. Constance has written a number of travel guides for Vancouver, Victoria, Whistler, and the Pacific Northwest, and a whole other side of your career there, Constance.
That's true, Wayne.
And you were also a contributor to Maclean's back in its glory days, but you don't seem to put that ever into your biography.
Listen, I'm at that stage in my life where I've done things 50 years ago that I've forgotten about completely.
She's earned her BA at the University of Guelph and completed a master's degree at the University of Alberta. And Constance is a Jays fan, so 20 points to you for that. And you're working on a posthumous work of Larry's for the press, and we'll talk about that. The occasion for today's conversation, however, is the 20th anniversary edition of Larry's 1998 play about residential school, Ora Pro Nobis. Constance, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Wayne. It's great to be here in Toronto.
Yeah. Let's start out by talking about this 20th. Isn't that something? 20th anniversary edition.
I know. It's when I look back and I think that Larry, myself, and Vera Manuel had the guts to publish this book. Like, I had a small publishing company that specialized in plays, believe it or not. And I said one day to them, listen, let's put the two plays together, because one represents the boys, that's Ora Pro Nobis, Pray for Us, Larry's play, and Vera Manuel's Strength of Indian Women represented the girl side. Although Vera wasn't a residential school survivor, she was an intergenerational survivor. And the plays just work really well together.
So take us back to that time. This would have been the 90s. That wasn't Larry's first play, his first work, but you would have met just around that time or a few years before that. So how did you and Larry meet? And take us back to that period of time.
Okay, so I had had a car accident, and I was having trouble focusing because of whiplash, and somehow a friend of mine got me a job at the Carnegie Learning Center teaching a creative writing class. Now, I was a professional writer. I have been for many, many years, and a really good editor, but I'm not a creative writer. So into this creative writing class comes this quiet Cree man, who I found quite attractive, but took me a while to kind of admit it. I just got to be friends with him. He didn't really look very highly on my teaching, because what I found later on was that he had two fabulous creative writing teachers who are still friends of his. And here I was, you know, basically a non-creative writer teaching this creative writing class. But we worked through that. There was a coffee in a restaurant where the mouse ran across the floor. And I think that sort of cemented our relationship.
So you became not only romantic partners, but writing partners. And what would have been a disadvantage to you back then, not being a creative writer, but an editor, turns out to be brilliant, because you complimented one another.
Yeah, you could say that again. I mean, that was just what he needed, what I needed. He needed somebody who had the experience to get everything down on paper, get it out, help him with his outlines, because he worked very hard, like might be a year doing an outline for a book. But he knew exactly what he wanted to write. There was never a doubt. If I put in 5 words into one of his books, like when we're working on it, like, and I'm typing away or retyping, he'd say, oh gosh, now we have to throw the whole thing out. That's not what I wanted to say. I say, no, just take those 5 words out. So he really had a vision for what he wanted to write about. As for me, you know, I was doing a lot of writing, history and travel, but it didn't really have any depth or meaning for me. It was a job. So what I got from being with Larry was I got a meaning for what I was doing. a deeper meaning, a door opening to another culture, and a beautiful relationship.
You did have this other life. You were doing, I guess, journalism before you met Larry, or you had done some journalism work. In fact, I managed to pull a few of your McLean's pieces here. I found them online. I can only get... You have to pay to actually read them, but I found a few headlines. Tell me if you remember these. Here's one. It says, Strippers of the World Unite.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That was one of my first pieces.
September 3rd, 1979.
Yep. That was one of my first pieces at for McLean's Magazine, working under Peter C. Newman as the editor.
Yeah, those were the days, weren't they? I mean, they had a few... Suzanne Fournier was there. Roy McGregor was writing for them at that point. Of course, Alan Fotheringham was there forever.
Alan Fotheringham was my guy because I was the one that checked his pieces. You know, he got paid a phenomenal amount for that last page of McLean's. Well, at least it seemed phenomenal to me at the time. And he would write the piece and it would come in on a Wednesday and it would have to go into the, you know, the press like on Saturday or something. And I would check it. And so, like, say he was doing a piece and he was mentioning baseball stats. And then I'd call him up, Alan, Wisconsin's here. Do you know that pennant wasn't in 1949? It was, are you sure? Oh, no, you've got to be wrong. So I was always, maybe they got me because I was quite political with him.
So were you a columnist there, a paid columnist?
I started out as a researcher and then I went to be an assistant editor.
Okay. Well, that sounds like it was a pretty good gig. And at some point, I guess you just decided this isn't really what I want to do then.
Mm-hmm.
Went off in a different direction.
A lot of things happen at a big newspaper or magazine or whatever. There's a lot of politics. Yeah. Let's leave it at that, Wayne.
Give me all the dirt.
But you didn't mention the story I did about the witch's coven.
Oh, I've got others here. We could keep going. Which one was that? Well, I can read you the headlines here. This is what I got. Or this is what I found. They were all from like 1979, 1980. Music for Kids with the Glint of Gold is another headline. That Old White Magic.
That's the one.
Is it? Okay.
I think.
These were all from like 79, 80. So.
Yeah. I think around after that, I left McLean's and went freelance.
So by the time you meet Larry, I mean, you weren't kids anymore, the two of you.
No. I was in my mid-40s, and he was 14 years older than me. So he was in his... He went back to school when he was about around 55 to make his dream come true of becoming a writer.
Wow.
And, you know, he never backed off. He never said, I can't do this, or this is too demanding, or he didn't complain. No matter what, the whole time, the whole 24 years we were together, he had such a clear vision of what he wanted to do, which was share this culture that he loved with readers.
Well, most of his books, I would say, they're largely about his childhood, not only during residential school, but before. When you look at, for instance, the book that's coming out now, the 20th anniversary edition, that was a play. I wouldn't say that was necessarily... for younger readers. Eventually, what you ended up doing, the two of you together, were writing books that were, I wouldn't call them children's books in the sense that only children would read them, but they were accessible and appropriate for younger readers, like grade 5 and up kind of thing. And there seems to have been some change of thinking there. These early works that Larry was doing that were the plays and then moving towards writing books for younger audiences. So I mean, was that partly a result of the two of you working together? How did that change come about?
Well, for one thing, I had a master's in theater and I had been publishing plays. So I did know how to put a play together. So that was like mind-boggling. What a combo, right?
Yeah.
We went up north to Gruard where he went to residential school and we stayed in his cousin's place. And we wrote all summer. What he found from doing the play, and the play was done in, we took it on a tour to the federal prisons in Vancouver area. We did it at a United Church and Carnegie Learning Center. And then we did it at the Wisagatchek New Play Festival here in Toronto, which was great. We had some really good actors. Wonderful. Thank you. And then we actually went back to Canuso, which is near Gruard. and we work with the students in an elementary sort of high school, and we did the play there for a Cree gathering. And after that, Larry said, you know, I want to reach a wider audience. I'm going to write children's books.
Yeah.
And his books, like you said, they're not just for children. I think if you take As Long as the Rivers Flow, which was the first children's book in 2002, he's introducing the subject of residential schools in a time when people honestly questioned us when we were in the classroom. Did it really happen?
Yeah.
Didn't you get an education? You should be grateful. So just like in two plays about residential school, these were groundbreaking books.
Yeah, I would say, because I can go back to that time, and I remember having a lot of discussions with people like our friend Gail Valiskakis about doing curriculum or somehow presenting residential schools for young people and trying to figure out how to do that. And it was a really difficult conversation and a really difficult project. And you and Larry must have had conversations like that, but he just seemed to have a knack, just an ability to talk to young people. And I don't know if that was easy for you guys, if you just somehow hit upon it, or do you remember having those talking about how we're going to do this?
Oh yeah. Like we never, if anybody wants some advice, if you're going in the classroom, never wing it. Always have a plan. Because I think in the 1600 plus talks that we did in various schools, libraries and conferences and, you know, festivals, we always had a plan. And maybe the one or two times that somehow we didn't have a plan, it was like you'd reel away from, say, a classroom and, what happened there? So always have a plan. But, you know, it's, if you think that Larry was a quiet person, he wasn't shy. He corrected me on that.
Yeah.
I'm not shy. I speak.
He was
when
very strong in a quiet sort of way.
Yeah. And he never seemed nervous. I was the one that was like, if you want to think that kids in grade 3 and 4 can terrify you, I'm the one going, ooh. Yeah. But once we got in there, like I would be like the MC or the introducing person, that type of thing. And I really learned quickly that really, they weren't there to listen to me. Yeah, I'm good at that. But when Larry spoke, no matter what age the audience was, they listened. That shows his power.
Mm-hmm.
And the power of commitment.
What I've found as I've done things and gone out there is that there's this following of people that just, you know, adored Larry and his books. And I think it did help a lot that you guys were always out there. I mean, you traveled, you went, like you said, it seemed like you were forever on the road speaking to schools. And so he was very accessible. You know, he just made himself available to people and would talk to you and mm-hmm. whoever you are. And it just had an ability to really talk in a very simple, not simplistic, but just an accessible, simple way about residential schools.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was something that was touching to a lot of people, is that they knew him, you know, everybody met him and could tell a story and could hear his voice.
That's so true. Like there's some beautiful moments that when we were at schools, and Larry really loved going to these remote communities that writers didn't normally go to. You know, we'd get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and drive someplace, and then somebody would pick us up and take us to like a really remote community, bumping along a road that hadn't been paved and had 3 foot deep ditches. And we get to a school, and the teachers and the students would be so excited, and they'd be having a special lunch for us and giving us beautiful quilts that they'd made, not just one, but two, like one for me and one for Larry. And he just, you know, and asking, Larry, could you speak to this one boy whose grandfather passed away and he was living with him, and he's such a great boy and he's interested in writing, but he just needs a little encouraging word. And Larry would just go to that boy in a few seconds and he would just say the right thing because he knew his culture.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something I can't do. I can't step in for Larry because I don't know his culture. I'm not his culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the things that is I really miss the most, because Larry opened a door.
Yeah.
And I was very proud and honored to walk through it with him.
Yeah. You grew up in this part of the world, right?
Well, you know, maybe our travels were just part of our history, because I went to 11 public schools.
Okay.
So, and Larry, of course, had been in the Army, and he'd lived in Rupert and fishing. He had a lot of professions before he made his dream come true of becoming a writer.
Yeah.
Like, if you wanted to know something about fish or trees, because he'd worked in the fishing industry and he worked in the lumber industry, he knew every tree and he knew every fish. So he was the person to turn to.
let's hear from Larry. I've got a short clip here. This is from an interview that the two of you did for the CBC a few years ago. And it's Larry talking about residential school.
Going to residential school was the worst experience that I could ever have, because a lot of the smaller children were crying, and I couldn't understand why are they crying, because I was in grade 4 already in public school. So in the truck, the big 3-ton grain truck that we were transported from Slave Lake to Residale School was not the best vehicle for transporting children. They were all crying. So the thing I missed most was the schooling that I didn't get in Residale School, because we piled wood for 4 to 6 weeks, big blocks of wood for the furnaces in Gruard Residential School. So all that wood was about 3 to 4 weeks during school days, we piled wood. So that's one thing. And the next big thing was picking potatoes in the fall. That was another 3 weeks. That was during school days too, so we had to pick potatoes, and we had jobs, specific jobs, to keep the residential school going without having to hire outside help to run the residential school. So, yeah, I worked in the barn for a while, which was good for me because I was away from the school, and worked in the barn where nobody could holler and scream, don't do this, don't do that. Being called a sauvage, that was freedom for me because I was away from the voice of this nun who was not a very gentle nun.
Larry really wanted to go to school. Larry really wanted an education. And I heard him speak many times, and while we were working on the book, you know, he really wanted people to understand that he would have loved to have gone to school, and he wanted to be a writer, and he loved books. And instead, he was put to work. He would always talk about the wood, you know, piling the wood and picking the potatoes, and the fact that all he really wanted was to read books and to learn, and he wanted to be a writer. Do you feel like Larry did finally accomplish everything he wanted to?
No, because even a few weeks before he passed away at home, on April 18th, 2016, he was still talking to me about ideas for books.
Like what?
Well, he had one book that we were working on is Wild Waters, which is... it's the story of his 4 times great-grandfather, who was a Iroquois voyageur with George Simpson in 1828. We got quite far with that book, and I'm determined to finish it. He also worked quite a bit on a book called Darkness Walks, and it's about his godmother, whose name in Cree is Wanchipskau, which means darkness. And she was kind of a mysterious person in Slave Lake. And so he sort of intertwines her story with kind of ghost type of things, right? You know, and I asked him once when he was about 79, I said, Larry, do you think you're going to retire? You want to retire maybe when you're 80? Or he said, no. He said, I want to keep talking to people. I want to keep talking to children.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was really cool.
Yeah.
And so, of course, like, okay, I don't know what I was thinking of, like retiring in the South Seas or something.
Well, Larry was. I mean, I remember. I didn't actually have a sense. I knew that his health wasn't well, but I remember he was here in Toronto. We were at a conference or something, and he was still Larry.
Yeah, that was in summer 2015. And I'd asked him, because he was pushing 82, as they say, right?
Yeah.
And I asked him, do you think you want to do this? Because it was 3 weeks, I'd say every day except for one, in that 3 weeks we were working.
Yeah.
We were traveling, we were working, we were doing things with our publisher, Indigenous Education Press, Jeff Burnham, also the proprietor of goodminds.com. You know, we were selling books. We went to the book launch in Sault Ste. Marie at Algoma University, which is the co-publisher of Residential Schools with the Words and Images of Survivors, the book you worked on with us as well. So, oh my gosh, like we just went from pillar to post, but he did it. And I think that was his joy. Like he told me in the last few months, many times, he'd say, you made my dreams come true. Well, Larry, you made my dreams come true. You know, it was just a very nice thing for him to say. I think Larry was quite, you know, in control of his dreams, but it was so loving and sweet of him to say that. One thing I want to say, like, no matter what happened to Larry, he retained his sense of humor. And he always said that if you see a table of people laughing together, a big table, he said, go over and ask them, and 9 times out of 10, they'll be Cree.
yeah.
So he uses a lot of humor. In Two Plays About Residential School and Ora Pro Nobis, Pray For Us, he uses a lot of humor. And I think he saw that humor can make a message palatable.
Mm-hmm.
Because if he'd really come down heavy, I don't think the book would still be in print today. I mean, it's a classic now.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I don't think I've read anything that Larry has done, which I would say was angry or which was, you know, really getting into terrible details. I don't know if when you met him, he had kind of gotten to that place yet. Mm. Or if he always, if he, because, you know, I know people who, I know lots of people who are in residential schools, and I've known them long enough that I remember when they were still very angry. Mm-hmm. And you do see that kind of healing journey unfolding and that of evolution. And I know that Larry must have been very angry, or at least very disappointed in the fact that he was in this school as forced labor and lost all that opportunity to do the things that he loved. And as you said, he was in his 50s when he went back to school and finally started to pursue his dreams.
Yeah, he was angry. There were, in the first year, I think, that we were together, there were times when we didn't talk for weeks, a couple of weeks. He was angry. And then he started to really make an effort. And I think it was tied in with the writing. He knew he had to heal. He had to get past the, not let go of the anger, but be able to move on and leave the anger in a certain place, right? So he could write the books. And he did a lot of healing. He went to medicine wheels. He did sweats. He used his Cree culture. I'm a Buddhist. I've been chanting for 45 years, and he started to come to the Buddhist meetings because he liked to hear people talk about concrete spiritual things. He said, you know, it goes well with my Cree beliefs. That's how he got over it.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't believe in forgiveness. He said, I don't have to forgive, but I can move on. Hmm. And that was his choice.
The Roundtable, WayneKSpear.com.
So what was your writing process like? I've always been curious about that because I know the two of you work very well together. And I wonder what that looks like. Would he just sort of give you actual drafts of things, or would you talk through it or make notes or just kind of do outlines? How did you get from A to B?
Well, he said that he did his books in Cree in his head first.
Oh, okay.
So he would, like, Ora Pro Nobis, Pray For Us, or As Long As the Rivers Flow, any of the early Goodbye Buffalo Bay, which is the sequel to As Long As the Rivers Flow, he would work through them in Cree in his mind. And then he would, like, as Goodbye Buffalo Bay, which is also like amazing popular book, a true story of life in a residential school and of moving on. Then we'd do a long outline. We'd work literally a year on the outline. And then we'd start writing. So he would have notes. He would sit on his computer. He would do notes. He would do scenes. And then we would talk through some things. Sometimes I'd just say to him, just close your eyes and talk it through to me and I'll type it out for you, because I was a faster typist. It really happened, you know, it's hard to describe. I think what you said was all those things and more, right? Oh. But like I said, if I added something that he didn't like, oh, heads would roll. But he always knew, like in Goodbye Buffalo Bay, it was a long process to write it. So it was a year to put the, let's see, there's 23 chapters.
Yeah.
A year to put the outline. And then we wrote it. And so the writing, he didn't find writing painful, but I find writing very painful, this kind of writing, because I'm not per se a creative writer. Mm-hmm. And it's all finished for Thetis Books. And then Larry says one day, you know, I think we need another chapter. And I was like, okay, we were living in our log house then. I'm just going to jump off the balcony here. But he was right, because with a chapter he put in was when he went, one of his first jobs when he went to work in the oil patch, one of the early oil patches, and he meets up with Americans and strangers, and he flies in the first time in an airplane. So he was right, of course.
Tell me about the book you're working on now. Let's talk a bit about that. So this is one, because you've just described the process. So you had an outline, you had all your notes, you knew where the trip was going to go, and the journey's been mapped out. And now you're working to finish this book that Larry had in his mind and sketched out. Where is that now?
Do you have to ask?
No. I don't have to.
I
don't think people realize this. I mean, there's going to be more.
There's been
coming out.
There's been so much happening since Larry passed. Like, first of all, you guys and me as the third writer won the Golden Oak Award for residential schools with the words and images of survivors.
Yeah.
The Canada Council invited Larry to come to Cuba for the 150th anniversary to the Havana Book Fair. I said I was the co-author. I went in his place. I've spent months, like really mind-boggling months, putting all of our archives together, except for photographs, which I still have to do, for the University of British Columbia's new Indian Residential Schools Research and Dialogue Center. They're so grateful. It's the first contribution for their archives. They're going to have a ceremony.
Yeah, that's great.
In the next few months. So that's so cool. And then bringing out two plays about residential school again, that was quite a big job. So there's a lot happening. And the last thing is finishing. I've changed the title now, and Larry would completely agree, because titles were something we worked hellishly hard on.
Yeah.
So I'm calling it Wild Waters now, because Toma Voyager might not have got those youthful readers, you know? So we'll see what it ends up being. Mm-hmm. But don't worry, listeners, if you're having a hard time with the title of your book, can take longer to write the title than to write the book.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's actually based on a true story, because there was in 1828, George Simpson tried to find a faster route down to the coast, because he was always trying to save money and everything. So he takes his two canoes and they go up to York Factory, and then they cross over to the Fraser. And they go down the river and they almost die and all these things happen. So he found that his four times great-grandfather, Toma, was one of these. So anyway, we did the research. So what we've done, we've got everything done to the point where they leave York Factory. So that's all the creative stuff where he was putting himself in the mind of this 18-year-old Iroquois young voyager, blah, blah. So now we're on the documented diary of the trip. It should be easier now. But I was kind of daunted for the first year of trying to finish it. And I know Larry wants me to finish it. He said he did. And we would read it over where we got to 9 chapters. And he would say, that sounds good. So I am going to finish it, Larry.
But you're keeping pretty busy, and it's Larry's legacy. And you mentioned what they're doing there at the UBC. So that's going to have like his notes and letters and all that stuff.
It's all going to be digitized.
Cool.
It's a beautiful center. If people go out to Vancouver, go out to UBC.
It's a beautiful building out there.
It's a new building. It's just a beautiful building. And they told me, they said, well, you can just throw everything into boxes and send it to us. They sent a courier, you know, to pick it up. I said, listen, if I did that, you would hate me forever. So I spent 4 to 6 months creating files, organizing everything. It was like, oh, it's hard. But it's that part's done now. So I feel really a lot of satisfaction. And Larry wanted that. So check. One more thing I'm happy to have done.
Yeah. And you've got your website, of course.
Yes, firstnationswriter.com. And I'm still working on, updating. There's 4 clips of Larry talking about residential school. There's information about all the books, firstnationswriter.com, how to order, and all of that. Like goodminds.com in Brantford has all the books. And then, the publishers, like Groundwood for As Long as the Rivers Flow, Thetis for Goodbye Buffalo Bay, and Residential Schools with the Words and Images of Survivors, and 2 plays about residential school from Indigenous Education Press. But you can get them all from
through your website. And you set up that, I mentioned the First Nations Writers Group. Is that actually a group? Are there other folks that are involved in that? I never understood. It's like a group of 2.
Yeah, Living Traditions Writers Group.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, one of our first projects, like we were totally into research.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, like with The Wild Waters, the Voyager book, we got a Canada Council grant, thank you, to go to these forts and do research on the route. Isn't that cool?
Right. Yeah.
So Fort Dunvegan, I think, was my favorite. A lot of research went into everything. So yeah, they got me thinking about the research for the residential school's history, that with the words and images of survivors. I mean, you worked on it with us and you know how much history there is. Like as we were traveling, we did interviews. We did hundreds of interviews. And then, some of them are in here, Geronimo Henry from Brantford. Mm-hmm. 10 years later, we're calling him up and saying, Geronimo, we want to use this quote that you had, and let me read it to you. And he knew us, over time. We'd taken photographs and stuff for the book too. And he said, did I say that? And I said, yeah, and you signed here too. We got the date. It was like August 23rd.
At 2:00.
1999. So it's pretty amazing.
Larry, or I think you might have called me or sent me an email and said we had this idea for a book. And I was thinking of doing the same kind of project, because to have a book where it's not just stuff out of the archives, it's people's stories and their photographs, and people actually, gave us things like, here's an object that we had in the residential school, or here's pictures that we took, which is hard to get. Most of the time you're getting pictures that the government took or the churches took, and they're kind of staged. So to be able to get memories and memorabilia, is that the word? Objects, things?
I think they call it. From people's personal lives? There is a word for it. It'll come to me.
But it's things that you're not going to see.
Ephemera.
Yeah, it's things that you're not going to see in other books or in the archives or that kind of thing.
That's right. And I just want to mention, too, that it is a national history. Like, it has 8 chapters, and it takes you right through in a very natural way, from one chapter we added was about the family relationships, because we realized that they were demonized. And that came to us in the middle of the night. Like I woke up and Larry's saying family relationships, and I'm going, you're right, we have to put that chapter in.
Yeah.
So it is a national history, but to have the groundbreaking survivors expressed in here. And we didn't put anybody in that we didn't know or hadn't done an interview We did take some excerpts from Simon Baker's book, for example, one, but Larry was friends with him. Mm-hmm. So that's another thing I'm really proud of. We didn't make people up.
Right.
You know, like anybody can write a residential school history, but let's face it, when you have a primary source like Larry Loy, why would you go to a secondary source? Like what I've learned as a secondary...
And that's been done anyways. Yeah,
what I've learned is like a secondary source, because I might know as much about residential schools as any white person in Canada, but I'm a secondary source, maybe even tertiary, you know, like really bounce me down the line, right? So that's the thing too with two plays about residential school. I wanted to say it once again, these two writers, Larry Loy and Vera Emanuel, spoke up at a time when it took a lot of guts to say, hey, it wasn't good in that school, in those schools. Mm-hmm. And I don't want them to be forgotten. Like, right. It's wonderful the things that have happened, like Aboriginal Healing Foundation, Truth and Reconciliation Commission, but it started with these people, the grassroots people like Larry Loy, like Vera Emanuel, Geronimo Henry, and so forth and so on, that we met all across Canada.
If not for them, this would still be unknown.
And it was my honor, really, talk about privilege. It was my privilege to meet these people and to be warmly welcomed. I was never made to feel like I didn't belong there. You know, Larry and I would sit, hey, we ran circles of residential school survivors, maybe 100 people in a circle in Edmonton. You know, and everybody told their story. And there was, hey, if it takes 2 hours, if it takes 4 hours, it's what we're going to do. How many people like me, a non-First Nations person, ever have a privilege to do that or be respected for doing that? I really am grateful to the survivors. Thank you.
Yeah, and you guys went to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission there in Edmonton, right? Or
mm-hmm. USA? That's right. Yeah. It was like a reunion.
Yeah.
And we, you know, we just brought books and we sat at a big table, like when you came down the escalator, and we were sitting there with a big table, and really nobody told us not to sit there. And then survivors would come and talk to us. We were actually working on the residential schools with the words and images of survivors. There's some photographs I took and some interviews we did in the book that we did at that gathering, like right up to the last minute. And that's because Indigenous Education Press, well, you know, they gave us the freedom to write whatever. They never directed us in any direction. Mm-hmm. So we counted on you too, Wayne. Wayne was the guy who brought us up to the modern times, because we knew everything till about Aboriginal Healing Foundation, where we did some photo research and other research for you guys. But you were the expert on that period of time. And wow, it's Larry's genius of an idea to invite you. And I said, yeah, because we always really got on with you and Gail Valiskakis, who was a dear friend of ours who has since passed away. We miss her too.
Yeah, that was a great collaboration. I'm so glad we got to do that book.
Residential Schools with the Words and Images of Survivors. There's a fabulous iBook.
Oh, yeah. We don't talk much about that, do we? We should promote that more.
That iBook is so good because, for example, in the opening pages of the hardcover, there's a couple of pages from the 1932 graduation document of the Kokolitsa Residential School, and just the two pages, and it shows one of our survivors and dear friends, Bill Walkham, with his graduating class. If you get the iBook through Apple, you'll see the whole 32 pages of that document. Now, isn't that phenomenal?
Yeah.
And you'll see, like, Bill Walkham's, he was the valedictorian, and his speech, and you can, like, he was a very pro-culture person. I think they thought they'd accomplished, you know, making him into a white person, but far from it. And he was a great storyteller. So you can read his valedictory speech and kind of put your own interpretation on it, see what he was really saying.
Yeah.
So that was great. And in the iBook, there's many, many more photographs. Like in the Friendship and Laughter, Coping with the New Life chapter, there's one photograph of four girls. And this was Violet Ogimau, who was a carrier, and somehow her mother had given them a little brownie camera, and they managed to get one roll of photographs taken before, the nuns took it away. And, you know, but there's one picture here of the four friends washing windows while they're sort of hugging each other, wearing their smocks and so forth. But in the iBook, we could put the other two photographs we had.
Yeah.
And they're very beautiful. So the iBook has like a lot more in it that I think just enhances it a little bit further. For $30 or whatever, it's really, it's a steal.
Yeah. And of course, you can go to places, I guess, like Amazon, too, not for the iBook, but for other things. So no excuses not to have, and you know, not just for kids, but I would say if you have younger folks, right, children, these books are great introductions to residential school, to learning about the schools. And Larry talks about his life before residential school. It's important to know that, too. He did have a life before residential school, and he did, unlike his siblings, he held on to his Cree language and never forgot that. And I know he was very proud of that.
Hey, do we have time to read you a little something from...
We sure do.
As long as the rivers flow?
Yeah, go for it.
Maybe something else, I don't know, but if you have time. But
yeah,
I want to just read a little bit about... just to pique your interest, his grandmother, Bella Twin, and he are walking in the forest. He can't go hunting with the men because he's too young. He's only about 7. And they're with her dog. So I'm just going to read you up to the point where the adventure really begins. So grandmother says, "Where is Whiskers?" Of course, that's her dog. As Lawrence poured water over the fire, Grandma grumbled out loud, "It's not like that silly dog to run off. He's usually afraid of his own shadow." She pointed up the trail. "The medicine I want grows just over that hill." Carrying her pack sack, she set off quickly, with Lawrence following right behind. Their willow branch fly swatters made the only sound in the forest. Grandma slowed down. "Something is not right here," she said. "All the birds are quiet." Lawrence looked around. The forest was still. Even the leaves seemed to have stopped rustling. Suddenly, he felt afraid. And that leads up to the story about how his grandmother, tiny little Bella Twin, his cook'em, shot the biggest grizzly bear in North America with her .22 rabbit gun that was held together with a piece of chicken wire. It's a great story, and it's the only really story in Larry's books that he put himself in there. Of course, he wasn't there when she really shot that bear. She was with her companion, Dave. But Larry wanted people to know about her because she was being forgotten. So he put himself in the scene. It's a great scene. Kids love it. There's one scene where it says in here, what if it was a cougar hiding in the trees? What would he do? And then I thought, one day, one of those students is going to say something. And sure enough, like we would start with grade 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 classes with this book. And what if it was a cougar in the trees? What would he do? And then this boy yells out, "Shoot him!" Oh God, I got to tell you one more funny little thing. So yeah. Bella Twin was a tiny little Cree lady. And after I read the scene, which, you know, goes on and, you know, the whole adventure, this little girl comes up and she's pulling on my sleeve. And I said, "Yes, do you have a question?" And she looks at me as 5'8" and a white lady. "Were you the old lady that shot that bear?"
Yes, I was.
So great.
No, a wonderful legacy there of some really, really great books. And I can't recommend them highly enough as somebody who rattled my brain for a long time figuring out, because I would get asked to go to schools and things. And when I was at the foundation, how do we write for young people? And you guys just figured it out.
I didn't figure it out.
Yeah, well, through your partnership.
Yeah, Larry Loy did.
These wonderful books came out.
And I'm really happy to have been, you know, and still, there's still a lot left undone. So,
so you're going to stay busy for a while.
Yeah, I would say 2018 will be, we'll be busy.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear that, Constance. And I thank you so much for giving me your time and coming on the show.
Thank you, Wayne. It was really, really great. And you've always been a good friend and encouraged us. And we really did love working with you on residential schools.
As did I.
Yeah, it was great. Thank you.